Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to Matt Cutts talking about his way of trying new things. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 6. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
A few years ago, I felt like I was stuck in a rut, so I decided to follow in the footsteps of the great American philosopher, Morgan Spurlock, and try something new for 30 days. The idea is actually pretty simple. Think about something you've always wanted to add to your life and try it for the next 30 days. It turns out 30 days is just about the right amount of time to add a new habit or subtract a habit, like watching the news, from your life. There's a few things that I learned while doing these 30-day challenges. The first was, instead of the months flying by forgotten, the time was much more memorable. This was part of a challenge I did to take a picture every day for a month, and I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing that day. I also noticed that as I started to do more and harder 30-day challenges, my self-confidence grew. I went from desk-dwelling computer nerd to the kind of guy who bikes to work for fun. Even last year, I ended up hiking up Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest mountain in Africa. I would never have been that adventurous before I started my 30-day challenges. I also figured out that if you really want something badly enough, you can do anything for 30 days. Have you ever wanted to write a novel? Every November, tens of thousands of people try to write their own 50,000-word novel from scratch in 30 days. It turns out, all you have to do is write 1,667 words a day for a month. So I did. By the way, the secret is not to go to sleep until you've written your words for the day. You might be sleep-deprived, but you'll finish your novel. Now, is my book the next great American novel? No, I wrote it in a month. It's awful. But for the rest of my life, if I meet John Hodgman at a TED party, I don't have to say, I'm a computer scientist. No, no, if I want to, I can say, I'm a novelist. So here's one last thing I'd like to mention. I learned that when I made small, sustainable changes, things I could keep doing, they were more likely to stick. There's nothing wrong with big, crazy challenges. In fact, they're a ton of fun, but they're less likely to stick. A few years ago, I felt like I was stuck in a rut, so I decided to follow in the footsteps of the great American philosopher, Morgan Spurlock, and try something new for 30 days. The idea is actually pretty simple. Think about something you've always wanted to add to your life and try it for the next 30 days. It turns out 30 days is just about the right amount of time to add a new habit or subtract a habit, like watching the news, from your life. There's a few things that I learned while doing these 30-day challenges. The first was, instead of the months flying by forgotten, the time was much more memorable. This was part of a challenge I did to take a picture every day for a month. And I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing that day. I also noticed that as I started to do more and harder 30-day challenges, my self-confidence grew. I went from desk-dwelling computer nerd to the kind of guy who bikes to work for fun. Even last year, I ended up hiking up Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest mountain in Africa. I would never have been that adventurous before I started my 30-day challenges. I also figured out that if you really want something badly enough, you can do anything for 30 days. Have you ever wanted to write a novel? Every November, tens of thousands of people try to write their own 50,000-word novel from scratch in 30 days. It turns out, all you have to do is write 1,667 words a day for a month. So I did. By the way, the secret is not to go to sleep until you've written your words for the day. You might be sleep deprived, but you'll finish your novel. Now, is my book the next great American novel? No, I wrote it in a month. It's awful. But for the rest of my life, if I meet John Hodgman at a TED party, I don't have to say, I'm a computer scientist. No. If I want to, I can say, I'm a novelist. So here's one last thing I'd like to mention. I learned that when I made small, sustainable changes, things I could keep doing, they were more likely to stick. There's nothing wrong with big, crazy challenges. In fact, they're a ton of fun, but they're less likely to stick.
Task 2. You are going to hear about Abraham Lincoln's life. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 1 to 7 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
The Boy's Life of Lincoln, written by Helen Nicolay. A severe and mysterious sickness broke out in the little Kentucky settlement where the Lincolns lived when Abe was about 7. Nancy Hanks Lincoln, the mother of young Abraham Lincoln, died. Meanwhile, Sarah Bush Johnston had married about the time Lincoln's father married Nancy Hanks. Her husband had died too. She was left with 3 children. Lincoln's father went back to his home and married the widow Sarah. The household goods that she brought with her to the Lincoln home filled a 4-horse wagon. Her own 3 children were well clothed and cared for. She was able to bring little Abraham and his 11-year-old sister Sarah comforts they had never known. The new stepmother quickly became very fond of Abraham. She encouraged him in every way to study and improve himself. Mr. Lincoln once wrote, "It was a wild region with many bears and other wild animals still in the woods. There I grew up." the family moved to Indiana. For 2 years, Lincoln went without schooling of any sort. The school he attended shortly after Sarah came was very simple. The Pigeon Creek settlement had only 8 or 10 very poor families. They lived deep in the forest. Even if they had the money, it would have been impossible to buy books, slates, pens, ink, or paper. In Lincoln's 17th year, he had more books and better teachers, but he had to walk 4 or 5 miles to reach them. We know that he learned to write and was given pen, ink, a copybook, and a very small supply of writing paper. The instruction he received from his 5 teachers, 2 in Kentucky and 3 in Indiana, stretched over 9 years. Altogether, his schooling did not amount to 1 year. The fact that he received this instruction, as he himself said, by littles, was an advantage. A lazy or not caring boy would have forgotten what was taught him at school. Abraham was neither indifferent nor not caring. Every moment of instruction was a precious step to self-help. He worked on his studies with very unusual purpose and determination. He wanted to understand them at the moment. He also wanted to fix them firmly in his mind. His early companions all agree that he employed every spare moment to his studies. His stepmother tells us that when he came across a passage that struck him, he would write it down on boards if he had no paper. He would keep it there until he did get paper. Then he would rewrite it, look at it, and repeat it. He had a copybook, a kind of a scrapbook, in which he put all things, and thus saved them. He spent long evenings writing sums on the fire shovel. Abraham worked his sums by the flickering firelight, making his figures with a piece of charcoal. When the shovel was all covered, he used a drawing knife to shave it clean again. He borrowed every book in the neighborhood. The list is a short one. Robinson Crusoe, Aesop's Fables, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. The Boy's Life of Lincoln, written by Helen Nicolay. A severe and mysterious sickness broke out in the little Kentucky settlement where the Lincolns lived when Abe was about 7. Nancy Hanks Lincoln, the mother of young Abraham Lincoln, died. Meanwhile, Sarah Bush Johnston had married about the time Lincoln's father married Nancy Hanks. Her husband had died too. She was left with 3 children. Lincoln's father went back to his home and married the widow Sarah. The household goods that she brought with her to the Lincoln home filled a 4-horse wagon. Her own 3 children were well clothed and cared for. She was able to bring little Abraham and his 11-year-old sister Sarah comforts they had never known. The new stepmother quickly became very fond of Abraham. She encouraged him in every way to study and improve himself. Mr. Lincoln once wrote, "It was a wild region with many bears and other wild animals still in the woods. There I grew up." The family moved to Indiana. For 2 years, Lincoln went without schooling of any sort. The school he attended shortly after Sarah came was very simple. The Pigeon Creek settlement had only 8 or 10 very poor families. They lived deep in the forest. Even if they had the money, it would have been impossible to buy books, slates, pens, ink, or paper. In Lincoln's 17th year, he had more books and better teachers, but he had to walk 4 or 5 miles to reach them. We know that he learned to write and was given pen, ink, a copybook, and a very small supply of writing paper. The instruction he received from his 5 teachers, 2 in Kentucky and 3 in Indiana, stretched over 9 years. Altogether, his schooling did not amount to 1 year. The fact that he received this instruction, as he himself said, by littles, was an advantage. A lazy or not caring boy would have forgotten what was taught him at school. Abraham was neither indifferent nor not caring. Every moment of instruction was a precious step to self-help. He worked on his studies with very unusual purpose and determination. He wanted to understand them at the moment. He also wanted to fix them firmly in his mind. his early companions all agree that he employed every spare moment to his studies. His stepmother tells us that when he came across a passage that struck him, he would write it down on boards if he had no paper. He would keep it there until he did get paper. Then he would rewrite it, look at it, and repeat it. He had a copybook, a kind of a scrapbook, in which he put all things, and thus saved them. He spent long evenings writing sums on the fire shovel. Abraham worked his sums by the flickering firelight, making his figures with a piece of charcoal. When the shovel was all covered, he used a drawing knife to shave it clean again. He borrowed every book in the neighborhood. The list is a short one. Robinson Crusoe, Aesop's Fables, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a photographer talking about his work. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 1 to 6 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Humanity takes center stage at TED, but I would like to add a voice for the animals, whose bodies and minds and spirits shaped us. Some years ago, it was my good fortune to meet a tribal elder on an island not far from Vancouver. His name was Jimmy Smith, and he shared a story with me that is told among his people, who call themselves the Kwikwa Sutanuk. Once upon a time, he told me, all animals on Earth were one. Even though they looked different on the outside, inside, they were all the same. And from time to time, they would gather at a sacred cave deep inside the forest to celebrate their unity. When they arrived, they would all take off their skins. Raven shed his feathers, bear his fur, and salmon their scales. And then they would dance. But one day, a human made it to the cave and laughed at what he saw because he did not understand. Embarrassed, the animals fled, and that was the last time they revealed themselves this way. The ancient understanding that underneath their separate identities, all animals are one, has been a powerful inspiration to me. I like to get past the fur, the feathers, and the scales. I want to get under the skin. No matter whether I'm facing a giant elephant or a tiny tree frog, my goal is to connect us with them, eye to eye. You may wonder, do I ever photograph people? Sure. People are always present in my photos, no matter whether they appear to portray tortoises or cougars or lions. You just have to learn how to look past their disguise. As a photographer, I try to reach beyond the differences in our genetic makeup to appreciate all we have in common with every other living thing. When I use my camera, I drop my skin, like the animals at that cave, so I can show who they really are. As animals blessed with the power of rational thought, we can marvel at the intricacies of life. Humanity takes center stage at TED, but I would like to add a voice for the animals, whose bodies and minds and spirits shaped us. Some years ago, it was my good fortune to meet a tribal elder on an island not far from Vancouver. His name was Jimmy Smith, and he shared a story with me that is told among his people, who call themselves the Kwikwa Sutanuk. Once upon a time, he told me, all animals on Earth were one. Even though they looked different on the outside, inside, they were all the same. And from time to time, they would gather at a sacred cave deep inside the forest to celebrate their unity. When they arrived, they would all take off their skins. Raven shed his feathers, bear his fur, and salmon or scales. And then they would dance. But one day, a human made it to the cave and laughed at what he saw because he did not understand. Embarrassed, the animals fled, and that was the last time they revealed themselves this way. The ancient understanding that underneath their separate identities, all animals are one, has been a powerful inspiration to me. I like to get past the fur, the feathers, and the scales. I want to get under the skin. No matter whether I'm facing a giant elephant or a tiny tree frog, my goal is to connect us with them, eye to eye. You may wonder, do I ever photograph people? Sure. People are always present in my photos, no matter whether they appear to portray tortoises or cougars or lions. You just have to learn how to look past their disguise. As a photographer, I try to reach beyond the differences in our genetic makeup to appreciate all we have in common with every other living thing. When I use my camera, I drop my skin, like the animals at that cave, so I can show who they really are. As animals blessed with the power of rational thought, we can marvel at the intricacies of life.
Task 4. You are going to listen to Stella talking about going to a pop concert. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 8, with the sentence endings, A to K. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, zero, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
So the last concert that I went to was Simply Red, and it was back in, I think, November before Christmas, and I really hadn't reckoned on it at all. A friend of mine from Innsbruck was supposed to be coming to go with a friend of mine, Anna Marie, and I think it was the day before she broke her foot. She fell off a wall, I think, and she phoned me up and she offered me the ticket. And I was like, are you sure? And I said, well, how much do you want for it? And she said, no, it's free. And I was like, really? You're giving me a free ticket? I was like, okay, then, fine. I felt really, really bad, though. I was like, well, she can't go because she can't walk up the steps and I'm getting to go instead of her. Anyway, it was really nice. Anna Marie came to my place and she picked me up and we walked. It was only about 10 minutes, I think, something like that. Then we got there. Then we had something to eat. We had one of these huge big pretzel things and a drink. And we walked in and the place was just completely empty. It was like this huge big concert hall and it was, there was hardly anyone in there. It was very strange. Although it was supposed to have been sold out. The pre-band was this gospel thing and the screen was really, really small. And I thought, if this is going to be the same with Mick Hucknall and Simply Red, then we're not going to be able to see much. Then, of course, people started really slowly coming in, and then it really got full. It was completely packed. Mick Hucknall on the stage, he was tiny with this kind of crazy red hair, and it was actually really, really cool. Beforehand, because I couldn't remember Simply Red, I kind of YouTubed them, and I thought, oh, I remember this song, and oh, that was really cool. And some of the songs were absolutely brilliant. The beginning, really, really good. In the middle, I kind of zoned out a bit. The end was really good. The atmosphere in the place was excellent. It was just wow. And then the crowd was singing along, and it was just really, really good. Oh, both of us were singing along. Anna Marie was singing along as well. And then after the concert, we went to this really nice little bar and had a really nice cocktail. So that was my last experience. So the last concert that I went to was Simply Red, and it was back in, I think, November before Christmas, and I really hadn't reckoned on it at all. A friend of mine from Innsbruck was supposed to be coming to go with a friend of mine, Anna Marie, and I think it was the day before she broke her foot. She fell off a wall, I think, and she phoned me up and she offered me the ticket. And I was like, are you sure? And I said, well, how much do you want for it? And she said, no, it's free. And I was like, really? You're giving me a free ticket? I was like, okay, then, fine. I felt really, really bad, though. I was like, well, she can't go because she can't walk up the steps and I'm getting to go instead of her. Anyway, it was really nice. Anna Marie came to my place and she picked me up and we walked. It was only about 10 minutes, I think, something like that. Then We got there, then we had something to eat. We had one of these huge big pretzel things and a drink. And we walked in and the place was just completely empty. It was like this huge big concert hall, and it was, yeah, there was hardly anyone in there. It was very strange. Although it was supposed to have been sold out. The pre-band was this gospel thing, and the screen was really, really small. And I thought, if this is going to be the same with Mick Hucknall and Simply Red, then we're not going to be able to see much. Then, of course, people started really slowly coming in, and then it really got full. It was completely packed. Mick Hucknall on the stage, he was tiny with this kind of crazy red hair, and it was actually really, really cool. Beforehand, because I couldn't remember Simply Red, I'd kind of YouTubed them, and I thought, oh, I remember this song, and oh, that was really cool. And some of the songs were absolutely brilliant. The beginning, really, really good. In the middle, I kind of zoned out a bit. The end was really good. The atmosphere in the place was excellent. It was just wow. And then the crowd was singing along, and it was just really, really good. Or both of us were singing along. Anna Marie was singing along as well. And then after the concert, we went to this really nice little bar and had a really nice cocktail. So that was my last experience.
This is the end of the listening test.